I start, can I get a show of hands how many people have ever heard of mental health first aid? See, now I want a photo. And how many of you have ever done a mental health first aid course? Ah, that is a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. Okay, what I'm going to be talking about today is non-suicidal self-injury, which is a subset of self-harming behaviours. And what I'm going to be looking at is how do we identify that a young person might be engaging in non-suicidal self-injury, how we can start a conversation, and how we can help a young person to make other decisions, seek other coping strategies. And we're going to finish up a little bit about how we can support a young person whether it's in the short term or long term setting whilst they are learning new coping strategies and finding new ways of managing distressing feelings. And throughout, I've got a few little quotes from people who engaged in self-injury when they were young and have made a good full recovery and are able to reflect on some of those experiences. So, I think I've already given you your overview. So, let's start with, this is Madeline Strong from her book, A Bright Red Scream. I would constantly be looking at it, the self-injury, in the mirror and touching it under my clothes for the next few days. It was as if I had a hidden secret or strength that nobody knew about because I was in control of the pain. It wasn't inflicted from the outside. So, we're already seeing that non-suicidal self-injury occurs as a response to pain that is overwhelming, that a young person has a need to cope with in some way. So what is non-suicidal self-injury? And I think it's useful to think of non-suicidal self-injury as a subset of self-harm. Self-harm can really be defined as any kind of behaviour which is harmful to the self that a person does themselves. Non-suicidal self-injury is specifically about the act of causing physical harm to oneself without intent to die. So we're not talking here about suicide attempts. We're not talking here about risk-taking behaviours or substance use, although there might be some similar things behind all of those behaviours. So what is it? It is largely injuries to the skin. Some of you might have heard of this study before, the ANESI study. This is the Australian National Epidemiological Study of Self-Injury, which was conducted by the Centre for Suicide Prevention in 2008. And it was the first one of its kind internationally, being a population-level study, rather than not schools specifically, not patient samples specifically, but just the general community, looking at how common is self-injury in all age groups. As you can see, cutting and scratching are both the main form of self-injury that occurs amongst women, and amongst men, it tends to be hitting a body part against the wall and getting really frustrated and punching a wall, or even potentially sort of hitting themselves. But there's lots of overlap, and most people use more than one form of self-injury. These are the sorts of injuries that we're most likely to see. How common is it? I think it's really important to start off with the statement that it occurs in all age groups, but it is most common in young people. And in fact, we tend to see the first episode of self-injury prior to the age of 17, and it may or may not go on to be a habit which occurs into young adulthood. So when we look at over the last month, about 2.5%, about 1 in 40 10 to 17-year-olds, and really it's going to be a little bit higher if we were looking at, say, 15 to 17-year-olds, have engaged in some form of self-injury in the last 4 weeks. Over 12 months, it's more, it's about 5%. We're starting to see a little bit of a difference there between men and women, though you're probably you might be surprised at how close those figures are. And over a lifetime, so those under the age of 17, about 10% had injured themselves at least once in their lifetime. So why does it happen? I think that this is really important because I go into schools and I go into community settings and I hear it's all manipulation. They're after attention. They're drama queens. In fact, at times, yeah, it can be a way of asking for help. And it's not a particularly effective one. I tell you what, when you show up bleeding and say, hey, this is how much pain I'm in, you're more likely to get punished than helped immediately. It is a lot of, this is not how you ask for help, you make an appointment. Okay, I'll schedule my distress for a more appropriate office hour in the future. So it can often be about using language that is available. So, you know, if somebody's drowning and waving their arms around and screaming for help, do you say, make an appointment? I hope not. Please don't. Okay, so yes, there are a small number who actually engage in this behaviour to communicate to somebody else or to influence other people's behaviours, but for the most part, it is overwhelmingly about managing emotions or about punishing myself. And I think that's the key thing to take away here. So the overall theme is that the current state is intolerable, and self-injury can make that current state tolerable for a little while. It's not going to work forever, and that's why injury can become a pattern. And really, for people who find that non-suicidal self-injury is effective in managing their distress, it works really quickly. Why look for something else? It's the same as someone who says, I fight with my parents and it's horrible, so I get drunk. And getting drunk works. Why look for something else? It just becomes the main form of strategy. And a couple of really interesting quotes that support this. You might imagine that a person would resort to self-mutilation. I hate that term, but that was the term used. Only under extremes of duress, but once I had crossed that line the first time, taken that fateful step off the precipice, then almost any reason was a good enough reason. Almost any provocation was provocation enough. Cutting was my all-purpose solution. Something as simple as paying my rent a day late could provoke, indirectly, the internal suggestion that I engaged in self-injury. I was guilty, bad. Self-injury was, the internal critic suggested, an appropriate response to my behaviour. Very similar themes across all of those. Why look for an additional coping strategy when this one works so well and so quickly? What I'm going to be focusing on for the rest of this session actually comes from our mental health first aid guidelines for assisting somebody who's engaging in non-suicidal self-injury. I would really encourage you to have a look at these yourself. I'm going to summarise the most important aspects of the guidelines, but you can download them from our website. And you can also download a short list of alternatives to self-injury, which may be of assistance when you're helping a young person look for other coping strategies. I really want to say, before I actually start looking at the content of this, that this is not my opinion. This is not the opinion of Mental Health First Aid Australia. We conducted what we call a Delphi study, which is a method of reaching consensus within and between groups about the best way to do X. In this particular case, it was how to assist a young person or a person who is engaging in non-suicidal self-injury. So this is a large panel of experts recruited internationally. And when I say experts, yes, I do mean clinicians and researchers, but I also mean people who have a lived experience of self-injury and carers, particularly parents, of young people who engage in self-injury. So to start, the most important thing is not to ignore the warning signs or your own suspicions. What might you see? Look, honestly, you might see injuries. And it's just cat scratches. But the cat always scratches in the exact same spot and tends to scratch sometime over a weekend when a young person's feeling pretty rough. It's probably an excuse. Changes in clothing style are a big one. A young person might actually just point blank stop engaging in sports where they have to wear a uniform that might be revealing, or wearing long jeans and long sleeves during the middle of summer, that sort of thing. If you are a parent or otherwise live with a young person, you might see that first aid supplies go missing in large quantities. Or it might actually be about sort of protecting injuries. You know, a young person might actually seem to be in pain when they've been bumped only lightly. The key thing is, don't underestimate your own expertise about the young people who are under your umbrella, whatever shape and form that umbrella might take, because you know stuff about them. And if you've got a strong suspicion, ask the question. But ask the question after giving a little bit of reflection first. You want to be able to ask the question in a way that is not threatening, is not judgmental. I'll tell you what, going up and saying, "You're not cutting yourself, are you?" doesn't go down particularly well. Neither does, "You know that's got a scar." So you want to say something like, "Hey, you know, I've noticed some things, I'm pretty concerned." You want to make sure that you go somewhere private to talk. Grabbing a young person on their way out of a classroom is a great way of making them feel highly scrutinised and encouraging gossip about them. So have a think about when is the best time where you've actually got time to manage it if the initial response is floods of tears, which can sometimes happen because, holy crap, somebody noticed. And whatever you can do, of course, to minimise distractions and interruptions. You know, if it's your office hours, don't do this in your office. Find somewhere else to do it. So what might you say? I've noticed you've seemed unhappy lately, or distressed, or whatever it might be that you've seen. And just now I noticed that you have some cuts on your arm. Sometimes when people are unhappy or distressed, they deliberately injure themselves. Is that what's happening here? When you ask a question in this sort of way, you're communicating a whole lot. First of all, you're not afraid of talking about it. You know something about self-injury, enough to have actually even broached this topic, and you're a safe person to talk to. There's nothing in here that's immediately judgmental. You want to avoid shock, disgust, anger, and you don't want to focus on stopping the self-injury. Well, that doesn't make any kind of sense at all, does it? But actually, no. Your role as a first aider, as a caring parent, as a teacher, or other kind of school professional, or even I know some of you come from other community settings, that's not going to be your role. Your role is actually going to be to see if there's anything you can do to help ease the distress while a young person waits to see someone who can help with that. Something that's really important is actually to assess for suicidal thoughts. People can injure themselves when they are suicidal. It does not mean that the injury was intended to result in death. We also have guidelines for suicidal thoughts and behaviours. Again, can be downloaded from the web, but three key actions. If you can remember these three key actions, you can save a life. If you think someone may be suicidal, ask them, are you having thoughts of suicide? It's a fairly simple question. Really good way to ask, though, because things like, you're not thinking about suicide, are you? That's very much, you know what, they know what you want their answer to be. Or you wouldn't do something stupid, would you? Pretty ambiguous. So we actually want to ask, are you having thoughts of suicide? If a young person says, yes, I am, don't leave them alone. Work together to keep them safe and seek professional help. So, of course, with non-suicidal self-injury, the injury might actually need some attention. It might be that you need to offer some first aid. Don't insist on providing first aid. But remember that a young person who has developed a pattern of self-injury is probably doing it in a very similar way each time, and if they do their own first aid, that might be part of what they need to do. It might actually be a way of apologising to their own body or of sort of closing their session, in a sense. And if you take that away from them, they're likely to need to injure a little bit more quickly. Like if I make a sandwich, okay, and you guys don't really want me making sandwiches. I don't know why, but you don't. Making sandwiches is my primary coping strategy. But you come along and you find that I've made a sandwich and you take it away and you eat it. Okay, the point of me making the sandwich was to eat it. If you've taken it away, I'm going to have to do that again and I'm going to find you. So don't insist on first aid, but there are times when you might need to seek professional help here. Medically severe injuries need medical attention. Any cut over 2 centimetres long which gapes, any burn to the face, feet, hands, or any burn over the size of a 20-cent coin needs to be seen, and all self-poisoning needs to be seen. Key things are really about communicating with care and empathy. So rather than saying, you really worry me when you do these things, saying, I am really worried about you. It shows empathy and it shows that you are motivated to help. You have to stop this. It's dangerous and you will end up with scars. Not helpful. We can get you the help you need to find other ways to cope is a much better way of saying that. You're manipulative, passive-aggressive. You're just after attention. Now, if somebody is after attention, they actually need attention. I know it's groundbreaking stuff. In fact, the approximate percentage of people who need attention at times is 100%. And a young person who is willing to go to that kind of extreme to seek the attention they need is in need of pretty urgent attention. I like thinking of it as connection-seeking behaviour or care-eliciting behaviour. We can find other ways for you to ask for help. What if they don't want to talk? You reckon that happens from time to time? Asking if there's somebody else who can do it is a really good way to go. It might be that someone of your gender, of your age, of your position in their life is the wrong person for them to talk to at that point. And that's not about you, that's about where they're at. So please don't take offence to that. You might be able to recommend some other people in the community, whether that's inside the structure that you are in with them or outside. Let them have some time. You know, it might be that they need to go away, let their racing heart calm down and cope with the fact that somebody has noticed and somebody wants to help to make things better for them. If you say you are going to follow up, be the reliable adult, and never forget that you might be the only reliable adult in a young person's life. A few things around privacy and confidentiality. You can't keep self-injury a secret, but that doesn't mean that it can be gossip. Not everybody is going to need to know. It's great to seek permission to share information and to be really clear about what's going to be shared and who's going to be told. Remember that there might be aspects of what you've heard from a young person that could endanger them. A young person who is experiencing struggles with gender or sexuality, for example, turning around and telling their parents might place them in danger, and you don't know unless you've asked that question. You always need to work within the confines of what your own organisation can do, but a key person who can tell you if a young person is in danger if information gets shared is actually the young person. Is professional help needed? I always say that at the very least, if you do not have mental health qualifications, you want to get some kind of clinical assessment as quickly as possible. Even if the injury is not medically severe, that does not reflect the amount of pain that a young person is in. And if it is not medically severe now, 6 months down the track, it certainly could be. So we want to break that pattern as early as we can. So encourage the young person to seek professional help. And if they can take responsibility for doing that themselves, that's wonderful. That's actually helping to promote their own self-efficacy and their own capacity. If you can seek help on their behalf, if the person asks you to, obviously that's terrific. If it's becoming more severe or more frequent, and when I say severe, I'm not talking about the amount of pain they're in, but the actual injury itself is becoming medically severe. If self-injury is getting in the way of daily life, if caring for injuries is actually preventing participation, for example. And finally, if the young person is expressing thoughts of suicide. Who can help? Pretty much anyone who can help young people is going to be able to help in this situation. School counsellor is a really good place to start. The GP is a really good person to actually have a look at injuries. Don't forget that, you know, although we are talking about potentially severe psychological distress, potentially mental illness, that the injuries are still in need of some kind of attention. We've at least got to have a look at how severe they are and whether or not professional treatment of some kind is going to be needed. Specialist mental health services, lots of you have got youth-friendly services in your area. And finally, Kids Helpline. And don't forget, Kids Helpline is for kids up to 25. So those slightly older young people in your orbit can benefit from that as well. What do you don't do? So many things you don't do. Don't minimise the distress. Don't ever look at an injury and say, oh, that's not bad, they can't be that upset. Guess what happens when you do that? You teach them that they have to hurt themselves much worse in order to get the help that they need. Don't make glib or dismissive statements. Don't say, but you've got a great life, or but you're so pretty, you don't want scars. Don't try to solve the problems, although it never hurts to say, you know what, let's talk about what some of the problems might be. And, you know, I reckon that probably someone is going to be able to help with some of those. If you've got some concrete ideas of who can help, young people can be very concrete thinkers at times, particularly when distressed, and that can be quite reassuring. Don't use guilt. Don't use threats. Don't threaten to withdraw your care. Don't say things like, if you won't help yourself, I can't help you. And finally, don't set goals or pacts or ultimatums. I had a fascinating conversation with a young woman a couple of years ago who said, you know, every day that I don't cut, my mum puts a gold star on the calendar. And I've got 6 months of gold stars and there's 5 of them I don't deserve. I should have gone back to the beginning every time. You know, it's not a good way of thinking about recovery. Recovery has setbacks at times. Supporting a young person who injures over time is it can be really, really tough, particularly at times of those setbacks. But respect, care and understanding is really important. If to you the thought of self-injury is just anathema and you feel like you can't really do any understanding, asking them to talk about it, if they feel comfortable doing that, maybe reading about other people's experiences of self-injury. And you'll see in your packs there that you can see where the source of some of my quotes come from. Not a bad start. Remember that it's going to take time to find new coping strategies. And the first and the second and the third time a young person tries something else and finds, oh my God, I have to sit here and be miserable for all of that time, you know, that's going to be really tough. And that sometimes that's going to result in a young person having a little bit of a slide back. One of the hardest things in recovery is actually realizing not only that at times you have to sit with distress, but that every single other person does it. That takes time. When we talk about alternatives to self-injury, I think it's really important that we are clear that these do not replace professional help. We don't look on the web and say, oh, we can fix this, we just need to find alternatives. It doesn't work. What we are talking about here is things that we can put in place while between appointments or while it's taking time for other coping strategies to work a bit better, more sort of long-term psychological coping strategies. But they do not take the place of professional help. Okay, so the number one that we always recommend and the most strongly recommended coping strategy that came out in our guidelines is encouraging a young person to talk to somebody at times when they are distressed, when they have the urge to injure. Now, it could be something like calling Kids Helpline or a counsellor and say, hey, I really want to injure myself right now, and getting some support to make a better decision. Or it can really just be about talking to a friend or a family member about literally anything at all. People usually, and yes, there are exceptions to this, but people will generally not injure in front of another person. So here's a good solution, be with another person. You know, and although it might feel like it at the time, distress can't stay up here, not for hours and hours and hours. It comes down a bit, might go up a bit, it comes down a bit. You know, but realizing that actually there are ebbs and flows, passing that time in other ways is really great. And then we sort of talk about encouraging a young person to delay, distract themselves, or do something else. What on earth do those mean? Delaying is pretty clear. Encouraging a young person to wait 5 minutes. Most people injure within 5 minutes of the urge hitting. So wait those 5 minutes out. And then, whoa, I mean, that's an incredible achievement to get through 5 minutes of that much emotional pain. You've done it once, I reckon you can do it again. Actually supporting a young person to wait is a really good way of going, because again, they can't stay this distressed forever. Also just sort of think about being somewhere where they would never injure themselves. You know, if a young person says, well, it's always in my bedroom or it's always in my bathroom, and no, I'd never do it in front of anyone else, great, don't be in the bedroom or the bathroom and be around somebody else. When we talk about distracting, we're talking really about something that is engrossing. Watching a film, comedy film, something that might make them laugh. Yes, to some young people though, oh my God, this is why grown-ups are useless. I am miserable, I'm not going to watch a comedy film, and it's patronising. It was an idea, works for some people, doesn't work for everybody. The best strategy is always going to be the one that the young person comes up with themselves. But if they can't, they need you to take a little bit of initiative there and suggest some things. Engaging in exercise is great, a good way of kind of really pushing some of those wonderful endorphins and things. But exercise can also be so hard and so tough that it's just a different way of causing pain. So, you know, we kind of want to moderate that a little bit. And also doing something creative, particularly that might express some of those negative emotions, art, writing, poetry, diaries. And then, of course, finally, we've got to do something else. Now, this is a bit trickier. This requires a young person to have some sense of what function the self-injury is actually filling. So, finding that need and filling it another way. So, if I feel like I need to feel something, touching textures, holding ice, touching something that's warm, and I'm not talking about to the point of pain, can be other ways of actually just experiencing sensation. If I feel like I really need to punish myself, why not soothe or forgive myself instead? If I'm feeling really overwhelmed by emotions, you know, maybe I'll express emotions in less negative ways. You know, punching a pillow, maybe not something with a face. We don't want to promote any kind of sort of aggression or I've got to hurt something. any more than we want a young person to reinforce the idea that they need to hurt themselves. It is really key to avoid alternatives that cause pain. I see a lot of people recommending, oh, you put ice against your wrist and then you flick a rubber band. That is something that has been identified as a strategy within the context of a particular kind of treatment. By itself, all it does is continue to reinforce the relationship between pain and relief. I can't feel better until I cause physical pain. We don't want that. So to finish up with a couple of really positive messages, I think really important. I stopped cutting because I always could have stopped cutting. That's the plain and elegant truth. No matter how compelling the urge, the act itself was always a choice. I had no power over the flood tide of emotions that brought me to that brink, but I had the power to decide whether or not to step over. Eventually, I decided not to. And finally, again from the same author, maybe you have to make your journey and bear its scars. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. And please come and do a mental health first aid course if you have not already.